Today's podcast is brought to you by WarbyParker.com. Get a free 5-day home try-on at WarbyParkerTrial.com/FilmWaxRadio. 5 pairs, 5 days, 100% free.
This is James Ponsolt, the director of The End of the Tour, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Adam Chartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. You are listening to episode number 381 of the show. Thank you for doing so. This is a great episode, actually. This is one conversation. It's with a very, very talented and intelligent and fascinating individual named Richard Sandler, who is a street photographer and a filmmaker of note. He has been around quite a while. And I met with him in his East Village apartment, and this was back in March, actually, of this year, and I'm finally getting around to posting it. The main reason I am posting the show just now is because recently his new book of photography became available called The Eyes of the City, and it's really terrific. And on Wednesday, November 30th, he will be here in Brooklyn at Powerhouse Books for a launch of the book, and that is located at 28 Adam Street, again in Dumbo, Brooklyn, Wednesday at 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock. I cannot be there. I'm really frustrated. But I do know for a fact that Richard will be back in a couple of weeks. He mentioned this to me just the other day on the phone, that he's going to be at B&H Photo. And if I can, I will certainly keep people abreast of that information. I will post more details, since you're probably, if you're one of my regular subscribers, you may be listening to this on Wednesday, and it may be a little bit late. I'm sorry I didn't get this up sooner. My apologies about that. Sometimes that's just the way it goes. So I've known Richard for a number of years. It was a great, great conversation, very versatile. Not so much about filmmaking, actually, more just about life and about various projects and interests that have come up. And yeah, I'm very pleased with this. So I'm hoping you are too. Before we get to this conversation in just a couple of minutes, I did want to mention a couple of other things. I'm a fan of Dennis Hopper. If you listen to this podcast enough, you probably have heard me talk about Dennis Hopper, or works of Dennis Hopper. The Anthology Film Archives, which is, as any New Yorker knows, is located at 32 Second Avenue in the East Village. They are starting a program this Friday called Dark Hopper. And it says, this series aims to shed light on the wrongly maligned and largely forgotten roles that Hopper tackled between his official successes. In other words, you will not find in this particular series or program, you will not find Easy Rider, and you will not find Apocalypse Now, but you will find just about everything else that was during this period. Now, even I haven't seen everything in this. That's how good it is. This doesn't include Wim Wenders' film The American Friend either, I should mention. But here's what it does include. Starting on December 2nd, which is Friday, at 7:15, Out of the Blue, which is really, really great film. I would love to talk more about this film and Dennis Hopper, and I have some ideas about how to do that, but this isn't the time or place right now. But they are going to show Blue Velvet Friday night after Out of the Blue. Then they're going to be showing all through the next week The American Dreamer, which is a great documentary, which I've mentioned on this podcast before, directed by Lawrence Schiller and L.M. Kit Carson. Dennis Hopper directed a number of films, and a couple of them are going to be shown in the series in addition to Out of the Blue. One is called The Last Movie, and another is called Backtrack, or also known as Catch Fire. I have not seen that. And lastly, they'll be showing The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 and White Star, and I have not seen either of those. So there's some stuff I should probably get over to. All happening at the Anthology Film Archive. So I wanted to make a mention about that, since that's something that I think fans would be excited about. Okay, everybody, let's get into it. Let's get into the show. Again, this is Richard Sandler, and he's a huge talent. Just Google Richard Sandler and check out his website. Check out this book. Again, it's called Eyes of the City. I can't wait to get my copy. So anyway, hope you enjoy it. This is my conversation with him, and we'll be back next week. There won't be an outro. I'll only just finally, you know, implore you to go to my iTunes FilmWax Radio page. And, you know, especially if you enjoy this episode, go to FilmWax Radio on iTunes and leave a comment and a star and or a star rating. It'll help it tremendously. Thank you for that. Okay, so here it is. My conversation with street photographer, filmmaker, and all-around terrific individual, Richard Sandler.
Well, yeah, for recording field sound, but just voice in it is insanely good.
Oh, look at this. This is a thing.
This is a thing. It slept in my car last night. I put it in the glove compartment, and then I thought.
At least it was not visible.
No, but I had it in the glove compartment. You know, the side of the Mercedes in the center of the Mercedes. There's a.
What, a Mercedes?
Yes.
Like a nice old antique one?
Yeah, well, no, 2002.
That's an antique one.
But with only 78,000 miles on it.
That's the thing about that area, Rhinebeck. All those
IBMers? That was down by Poughkeepsie, actually.
Well, I was going to say, they all drive around in these really expensive cars. Because they all... The first thing these old cockers did is, they bought these expensive cars. I'm not suggesting you belong to that demographic, but...
That whole thing went right by me, but that was like real early in the computer era when IBM was booming there. You know?
Yeah.
That was like the first sort of boom all about it. Have you been to my son's restaurants?
No. What's your son's restaurant? Let's plug it while we're...
Okay.
We'll start off with Richard Sandler talking about what's Richard Jr.'s name?
My son's name is Benjamin,
uh-huh.
And he and
I like that name.
My daughter-in-law,
mm-hmm.
Jennifer Lim, have two restaurants in New York City. One is called the Queen's Kickshaw. That was the first one. It's in Astoria. It's an amazing coffee and comfort food and cider destination.
Really? Where in Astoria would...
This is right opposite the library on Broadway, just east of Steinway.
Okay. Very good. What's the other spot?
And the other spot is called Wassail. And that's at 162 Orchard between Stanton and Rivington. And Wassail is the first cider bar in New York City, the first sort of dedicated cider bar.
Interesting. I had some. I almost never drink it, but last night I was not in the mood for. I just wanted to get it. Then I bought a bottle of hard cider. It was okay, but it wasn't special. I'm sure this is what we're talking about.
Yeah,
as
you
far.
Go to my son's place.
I will. I'll try it out.
Really.
Yeah.
You'll really feel the cider vibe.
Well, he just paid for a sponsorship, so I feel compelled now to go.
But
no, I will go.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, it's amazing. There's like 15 or 18 ciders on tap,
mm-hmm.
and then there's another 100 plus in bottles from all over
the world.
Isn't
that amazing?
Yeah, this is a real cider experience. And,
there must
and
be.
Then it's paired with amazing food. There's a restaurant also.
That would be probably necessary to do.
Yeah.
I don't know if you could just do a cider place, but they had something in this store. It was just a bodega. I mean, it wasn't special, but they had a number of different ciders, and one was ginger cider. I was very tempted because I like ginger, but I figured, you know, I'll just go with these.
This is more like, you know, the variants of wine.
Yeah, no, I get it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's,
sure.
It's they're really seriously made.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
You know.
No, no, I know. I understand it.
From wild apples.
Yeah. No, there's a cult around this.
Very often.
Mm-hmm. Oh wow.
I was photographing apple trees yesterday in New Paltz for my son's restaurant for the walls. You know, put some pictures up with a Hasselblad.
Uh-huh.
Man, there's some really cool apple trees out there. They get so you know, sort of squiggly, and they, you know, they just go every which way, and they produce all kinds of runners, and they're very bizarre trees.
Huh. Speaking of Nukepulse, by the way, I should also add another connection. Just before we turned on the recorder, Richard and I were rehashing this. We've both forgotten, and it was a pleasure to re-remember that we were both lived in the same town, even though you preceded me a few years ahead. But and we know common people, Denise Weisbrot, for instance. But that another connection is the Hudson Valley one, which I went to summer camp for years right outside Nukepulse in Wallkill, the next town. If you go through Nukepulse over the bridge over the Wallkill River and you keep going, you'll hit the camp. So the summer camp. So I also grew up in the 70s going to summer camp there. And you know, number
was that
it's a hippie,
which side of the
pink diaper type spot, huh?
The Shawangunks, which side?
I don't remember, but we would hike there.
Yeah,
and we would
hike
up at Gertrude's Nose and up in the like up at what is it called? They had the great Indian names.
Mohonk.
Well, no,
Minnewaska,
and also
Awasting.
Awasting. You still hike through there every summer.
That was a destination because you couldn't actually drive there.
No.
You could only walk in. It was that remote.
Oh, okay. Well, I remember going to Awasting and Minnewaska. Yeah. I just love those names.
I lived, me and my first wife and son lived at the foot of that, just outside of Nukepulse, over the bridge, going over the Wallkill River.
Yeah.
And then making a left on what was called a Butterfield Road. I was there yesterday.
It's amazing. They always had that little farm stand right
on the corner.
On the corner.
Almost.
Yeah, yeah. And my camp counselor, I'm sorry, the guy who ran the camp lived on Tillman Road. I think that was the name of it. If you went down, it was right across from the summer camp. It was eventually, the land was bought by they're buying up a lot of property up there, I guess. Not the Christian Scientists, but another one. I'm blanking. Anyway, it was bought out, so we lost the camp. But it moved up to Vermont, and that's where I ended up moving up to. As a camp counselor, I worked up in Vermont for many years, so that was fun. It was nice to, at that point, I already felt like, okay, I've gone to summer camp here for like 5, 6, 7 years. I can enjoy Vermont now, which seemed exotic by comparison.
I was going to Nukepulse College in 19...
You mean like SUNY?
What's that?
SUNY.
SUNY, yeah. in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I was there and with my wife and my our new baby.
Huh.
Who's now
a restaurateur.
45.
Okay.
And has the restaurant Wassail.
Does he have children too?
162
Orchard Street. Does he have kids? Do they?
No.
Oh, okay. Two restaurants, I imagine there's not a whole lot of extra spare time for. And it's a night-oriented business, of course. So the idea of getting up early and taking the kids to school and all that is a big deal. So,
yeah, well, I'm hoping for a grandchild.
Oh, me too. Well, it's nice to sit together. And like I said, I was sort of just thinking about you, and I just thought, you know, this would be fun to do. No reason per se, other than just to kind of get to know more about you, and also to hopefully introduce you to some people, and or expand their knowledge of you in some way. Those who already maybe know your work as a photographer and as a filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
and as an actor of at least one Honor to Cal film.
Yes, working with Honor is one of the higher lowlights of my life.
Depending which morning you're.
I think I actually said that at the time.
Yeah.
Because he had me say things that were really bad. And I walked away from the set saying to myself, I think I have just been recorded on the saying the number one thing on my life's blooper reel.
If you think about it, Horner's films are blooper reels, only he gets rid of the stuff that's more conventional, keeps the rest, and he puts that up on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
But we're also here to plug Honor Tuchel's films.
Sure, why not? Lord knows I've done it many times in the past, and he used to be a frequent guest, and I'm sure he'll be back on at some point. He I just saw him a few months ago when he was shooting a scene in this new picture with the actual movie stars in it. So, you know,
he's getting hot.
I guess
he's breaking out.
He's going mainstream.
Yeah. Let's hope.
So you, let's go back a little bit. We know you're from Queens and then moved upstate, right? So when did you, I assume, and I correct me if I'm wrong, that you started as a photographer. Still photographer, I should say.
Oh, no.
No?
No, when I graduated Forest Hills High School, I was intent on becoming a doctor.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of?
I think I wanted to be a hematologist. I was fascinated.
Cancer? Or is that blood? Right?
Well,
blood.
Right? Yeah, blood diseases.
Yeah.
I was fascinated with that as a kid.
Huh.
Don't ask me why. And I spent...
Because that's a natural thing is to ask why, but I won't.
But what's interesting for you is, you know, growing up on 76th Road, uh-huh. is that, you know, directly across Queens Boulevard from where you grew up, there's a medical library.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's that big sort of brick building that's about only three stories, and it's kind of wide. And it's probably a little bit closer to 75th mm-hmm. than 76th.
Okay.
But it's on the other side of Queens Boulevard from where you grew up. Anyway, so I would, you Maybe. Know, study... Excuse me. I would study about blood diseases. And then I went to college.
As a hobby?
Yes, as an interest.
Okay.
I wanted to find a cure for leukemia when I was a kid.
But you don't have any reason for that. There's no reason. You didn't lose anybody to leukemia?
Nobody. No, I was just... I had a microscope. This is where my visual life begins.
Oh, very good.
Looking through my
Through a lens. That was the first lens you looked through.
Exactly. And oh. I had a pretty good microscope and was very nerdy about microscopes and optics. And I knew all about lights microscopes, you know. And now I'm using a Leica, which was obviously made by the same company. I was just blown away by the world inside of a microscope. And the lenses and the magnifications that you could get and the looks that you could create with, you know, various applications of oil, for instance, the so-called oil immersion lens, where the lens is actually in oil, the tip of it is in oil, and it reduces the distortion. You know, the spherical aberrations that happen when, you know, things are, magnified. Maybe that's not the right word, spherical aberration. But anyway, in photography, it certainly applies. Anyway, so, and then I just went to school to become a doctor, you know. And I was fascinated with looking at blood cells under the microscope. Like if you look at different animals' blood cells, they're crazily, interestingly... similar up to a certain point, and then they become very different. Like they have a nucleus, you know, and frogs and snakes and stuff like that. But then when you see mammals, the nucleus is gone. You know, it doesn't have that prominent nucleus because we have two kinds of, you know, blood cells, red and white. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's my phone.
Oh, very good. It's okay. I don't care.
Anyway, good. So that's where the fascination with optics came from. But I also was born into this really interesting family. My father was a lawyer. My mother was an actress who was on radio, stage, did Broadway a little, and became... a radio actress and then a TV actress. She was on The Goldbergs, which was the first sitcom.
Sure.
Yeah. Starring Gertrude Berg.
Okay.
She was on the radio show.
That was the radio first,
yeah, I mean,
right.
You know, radio became TV, basically.
I believe there's a documentary about that, mm-hmm. wasn't there, or something, maybe?
Yeah, she had a recurring role on The Goldbergs
what was
on
her
radio.
Name?
And Harriet Priestley was her name.
Okay.
So, you know, I was exposed to, you know, her artistic world and, artistic friends.
Was she progressive in a certain way, socially?
Yeah, my mother was a communist. She went to NYU. She was a pot smoker, you know, in the 30s.
Wow.
you know, hanging out with bohemians, you know,
yeah.
in the village, as an actress, you know,
yeah.
majoring as in acting at NYU, and she graduated.
Incredible.
She met my father, who was a lawyer, so they were like really opposite, but he was very allowing of her to be who she wanted to be. So
well, she was already that way. She didn't become exactly. that way. It's like he knew what he was getting yeah. involved with.
She wouldn't have signed on if right. he wasn't going to, you know, let her be herself.
And she maybe gravitated towards maybe somebody who's more of a rock in that way. You know?
Exactly. Exactly. Probably took her parents' advice. Their marriage was not really all that great, but they did give each other a lot of space, which in those days was a big thing.
Sure.
But the other side of it is I had two other parents. I had a godmother and a godfather who had no children of their own and who lived in the same apartment building as my family growing up, just on the other side of the building. And they became, you know, the closest friends of my parents. And I was born into a world where I had four parents because, you know, it was very convenient for my mother to, you know, pound the pavement in New York looking for jobs or, you know, actually doing them or whatever. My godmother would happily take care of me. So it was, and we developed the closest relationship imaginable so that to this day I feel like I had four parents.
What was her name?
Rosalind Duchovny. And she was married to Alan Duchovny. And Alan Duchovny, my godfather, wrote the words faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a steaming
Superman
locomotive.
Show?
Look up in the air, it's a bird, it's a plane.
Was that for the
Superman.
Show or was that preceded the show on the radio show? Was
this
that...
was the radio show, 1938.
They took that to television too, but that's because it was already a branded type of theme or whatever. That's
yeah.
incredible. He wrote that, huh?
Yeah, and he invented the characters of Lois Lane, Jimmy Olsen, and Perry White. They weren't part of the original idea. And he was...
They weren't in the comic books? Which
well,
I thought...
No, the property was bought.
Okay.
And the radio show and the comic book happened within months of each other. And it was just a huge hit. But it was my godfather, along with one other man. His name was Robert Maxwell, I believe.
And their names were Duchovny.
Yeah, Duchovny, Alan Duchovny.
Is there any relationship to the actor David?
There probably is, and he came to see my godfather when he was an aspiring actor just to find out if there was a relationship.
That's interesting.
Unfortunately, he sort of turned him away. I don't know why. He was a
your godfather
my
turned
godfather
the actor
was
away.
A little bit of a, he wasn't an actor.
No.
Anyway, so
no, I'm saying he turned the actor
oh,
Duchovny
yeah, yeah.
away. Saying, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know, who cares?
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so he was a press agent at DC Comics, and they get this property, Superman. I think they bought it for $100. And, you know, it was one of these stories of like, here, kid, see what you can do with this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's only 20. I don't think anybody thought much of it. But what he thought of it was absolutely brilliant, and I don't know if the brass at, you know, DC Comics thought this too. But he realized that he had an opportunity to sculpt the character of the opposite of the Nazi Übermensch. So whereas the Nazi Übermensch was this racist, horrible, you know, expression of all of the worst things in humanity,
mm-hmm.
Superman, who didn't even come from here, came
right.
from another planet.
Yeah.
He was going to be the embodiment of all that was kind and caring and compassionate, you know, in favor of integration, in favor of women's rights, in favor of truth, justice, and the American way,
mm-hmm.
which is what that meant in those days. That was a beautiful thing. You know, the American way was what the Europeans took from the American Indians.
Mm-hmm.
The best, you know, America's this hybrid between European and Indian. That's what America is initially,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
European and Indian. And the best things about America come from the Indian part of that hybrid, not the European part.
It's a very modern idea.
Well, it's a very true idea, particularly
yes.
when you study
yeah.
the history. This is not just speaking, you know, out my ass about it, but, you know, the the whole system of democracy comes from the Iroquois, which is the land that we're living in, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had developed a parliamentary type of democracy, where you were both, you know, a member of a larger polity, like a country, which would, in their case, was the Iroquois League, but you were also a member of your tribe. And then everybody in every tribe was part of different clans, mm-hmm. named after animals like bear or beaver or fox or,
right.
or eagle or whatever,
mm-hmm.
turtle. And so there were all these means of glue that held these six tribes together in terms of their identity. And with it was a common desire to live in peace, because they had problems before that. They were killing each other in blood feuds, not right. all-out wars.
They realized they needed a systemization of sorts.
Exactly. This guy was born. He was called a peacemaker.
And meanwhile, those that we call our forefathers are those earliest generation of politicians who were those that rejected the European monarchy style, wanted to do something more democratic. So you're saying that they were inspired by what they noticed.
Absolutely.
The Iroquois were using, even though they were decimating them at the same time, continuing to do it. They've already been doing it for a couple of hundred years.
I mean, you know, there were two kinds of people that came over here from Europe. You know, the ones that were just bent on making a lot of money off the resources that were here and still completely untapped. Europe in the 17th century had no trees left. Really had no fur animals left. They were living in their own shit and still dying of diseases. Obviously, they had smallpox still, chickenpox, cowpox.
Plagues,
mumps, measles, typhus, typhoid.
The greatest hits. Yeah.
The greatest hits of all time, and they brought that here. But the point of the matter
is... Which contributed also to killing off the indigenous
probably
people.
Most of the native people died from European disease. In fact, most of them died before they even saw a white man.
Oh, my God. Is that true?
Because if an Indian, let's say a runner, mm-hmm. you know, who would run from one area to the country to another, like teams of runners would run shit from all over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like obsidian and mother of pearl from the Gulf of Mexico was found in St. Louis at Cahokia, which was this huge town right across the river from what modern day St. Louis. There was a town that was probably about 100,000 or more, you know, in a central area, and then a sort of a metropolitan area that included, you know, hundreds of thousands. One quarter of the world's population was on the island of America in 1491. So there was 400 million people in the world in 1491, more or less, and 100 million of them lived on the island that is America from the tip of South America to the North Pole. 100 million lived there, and the other 300 million lived in Europe, Africa, and Asia, and Australia, and wherever else, you know.
Right. Wow.
So... Anyway, the point being here is that they had developed working democracies, sustainable ways of life, absolutely sustainable, even with the violence that they had. They were living in a sustainable world. Mm-hmm. The violence was sustainable.
Yeah, and also why we're not suggesting that violence isn't a part of, we equate, these sets of rules with what we call civilized culture, and that's not necessarily the case. There could still be punishments. Infractions that are retaliations for going against, you know, breaking understandings and contracts, and
you know, I mean,
your whole family must go.
You know, we live in a society that's unsustainable for the obvious reasons of, you know, climate change, and also nuclear bombs and nuclear power plants. This is a absolutely unsustainable, horribly threatening reality that we could
to
kill
the human
ourselves.
Race. Yeah,
we could kill ourselves off, and you know, we've been doing that slowly with other means. But the goal is not perfection, but just sustainability. So the human beings are fallible, and You know, everybody, you know, a lot mm-hmm. of people always do stupid, little stupid things or a lot of stupid things. Mm-hmm. And it's okay as long as that doesn't become the majority. If you live in a world where there's more goodwill than not, then it can easily contain, you know, the extremes and the you know, the behaviors that are unsustainable. As mm-hmm. long as that number doesn't get to too high of a level, you have a sustainable world. And that's all we're trying to achieve, I think, as living as human beings.
For you, the listeners of Film Wax Radio, Warby Parker is offering a free 5-day home try-on to give you the opportunity to check out their glasses. I personally love the idea of getting my frames sent to me at home so I can have all my friends survey the glasses with me and help me make my choice. But to get your home try-on today, go to warbyparkertrial.com/filmwaxradio. Again, that's warbyparkertrial.com/filmwaxradio for your free 5-day home try-on.
So, you know, the Native American cultures had all kinds of, like, provisions for people that were different, you know, and elevated them to the status of medicine man or woman or chief. You mm-hmm. know, they would be elevated in the tribe. Like the women, you know, the females that lived as males or the males that lived as females the mic is on the book that I read this in, The World's Rim, by Hartley Burr Alexander. And he talks about the people in the Lakota tribes who were, you know, men living as women or women living as men, and they would give you your secret name. You would have two names. One was the name you discovered yourself on your vision quest.
Right.
You told everybody who your name was. And then the other was this secret name in the Lakota that only they knew, because they gave it to you, because since they were different than everybody else, they could see into you beyond any of the conventions or possibly attachments of how people saw one another then. I don't know. I'm sure there were imperfections there as well.
And they didn't get a Jewish name, no?
Exactly. Yotzvi, come over here.
Pocahontas Ben Gurion or Ben Reuben. Or I sense it may be actually... What some might consider an advocation might actually be, okay, storytelling. He's doing, either you're telling me you're about filmmaking or you're playing charades with me, one or the other.
No, I'm saying I've been studying this for films that I'm making.
Oh, okay.
You know, this is research.
This is research stuff.
Yeah.
Not just for the sake of knowing.
Well, no, very much for the sake of knowing as well, of course. But just, you know, I'm making this film... On Martha's Vineyard, on the history of Martha's Vineyard. And I've been going there for like 44 years.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Martha's Vineyard.
And the day I arrived there, the first day I arrived there, I wound up inside the Wampanoag world there, the Wampanoag tribe that lives... and then it was called Gay Head. Now they've changed the name to Aquinnah, which is the local name. That's the tribal name for the place. And been very, very attracted to Martha's Vineyard and to the vibe of the place. Mm-hmm. You know how you can go to a place and just feel a certain energy that just moves you? And it's as if the land has intelligence itself that you respond to. It's almost like reading a book, except it's the land, you know? It's not a book. And it makes all the sense in the world. Well, anyway, I've had that experience there for all these years in my life. So I was introduced to the kindness and the beauty and the heart of these people on Martha's Vineyard the first day I arrived. I went to this... diner in Gay Head, that Helen Manning, it was her name, was the proprietress of. And, you know, she just welcomed me in a way that I'd never been welcomed before. You know, even in the warm Jewish bosom that I grew up in, mm-hmm. which is very kindly and can be very friendly, this was even kinder than that. This was even more realistic, and I don't know, just I responded to. So I've always had this very close association with the spirit of this tribe and these people before I knew they were, you know, a tribe. And anyway, so after I made The Gods of Times Square, my first documentary, which was this, you know, video documentary about Times Square from 92 to 98, mm-hmm. as the old neighborhood was changing and Disney was moving in, and it's about religion and about the function of Times Square as a place of freer, former Times Square, as a place of freer speech. But anyway, after that, I thought, well, what am I going to do now? And then it just, you know, was obvious to me that I was going to make a movie about Martha's Vineyard, a documentary about Martha's Vineyard. And call it AKA Martha's Vineyard, because obviously they have their own name for the island. There is no Martha, you know, and the vineyard aspect of it was not something that was, you know, an everyday reality in the lives of the Wampanoags living on the island.
Well, there's also agriculture, and then there's a vineyard, which sort of suggests the commerce behind the agriculture.
And that's how Europeans saw the land, like what they could make off of it. Yeah. But there was so many grapes growing wild there that they saw it as a vineyard, and they still grow wild, and they're extremely delicious.
I'm headed there.
Yeah, it's really good.
I should go.
You know, they
must have a film festival. They have a film festival.
Oh, yeah, they got two film festivals.
I gotta get connected. It's been on my mind. I gotta get to
it. You gotta get up there. Thomas Benna and Richard Paradise. Thomas Benna does the Martha's Vineyard Independent Film Festival, and Richard Paradise does the Martha's Vineyard International Film Festival, I believe. Anyway, they had the same name at one point. The Thomas Benna's festival happens this month, like the middle to the end of March. It's really good.
Yeah.
A Gods of Times Square show there.
I guess they have to be off season, because that would be just, they can't do it during the summer.
Well, no, this one, the other one is at the end of summer. It's also slightly off season. It's mm-hmm. Martha's Vineyard Labor. International Festival is in early September.
Right. Post Labor Day, though.
Mm-hmm. Post Labor Day, exactly. Mm-hmm. So the island starts to clear out.
Yeah.
And the land gets happy.
I'll start with them. The land gets happy. Yeah. But I know what you mean about the land. I used to have this in that area around Walkell, around Newport. It was very visceral, just feeling of going up there and connecting with the land. I don't know that I have it so much anymore, but when I was definitely a young person, and then when I would go back on occasion, I'd just be alone, it'd be quiet. I had very, very, very strong reactions to it. And then... Yeah.
So
in that region.
Anyway, this movie, AKA Martha's Vineyard, is all shot. It's a little bit of a unique movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little shy to say exactly what the uniquenesses are in a technical sense, because I don't want anybody to steal it.
Oh.
Is that realistic on my part, do you think, or just paranoid?
Paranoia might be an instinctual way of protecting something legitimately, too.
Can we turn the mic off and I'll tell it to you, and then we can start off and you can tell me whether it's paranoid or instinctual?
Okay. Wow. We're back.
That makes sense.
I could stick a commercial in there.
Okay, so it's a four-chapter movie, mm-hmm. and the first chapter is about the legends of the tribe and the sort of, you know, mythical underpinnings that all human beings seem to invent for who they are, where they came from, maybe where they were before they were born, and maybe where they go after they die, whatever. You know, the big question mark that hangs over all existence. That's chapter one. And then chapter two, and they're living in that comfortably, apparently, for ages and ages and ages.
Yeah.
So that's the longest part of the film, is the first chapter. The second chapter is the arrival of Europeans and how the land was repurposed by Europeans in their conquest, because it was an invasion. Absolutely, mm-hmm. there's no other way to look at this other than a military, you know, invasion and a species invasion And this disease invasion also. Some of it was advertent, some of it was inadvertent. But anyway, it was an invasion. So that's the second chapter, the history of the contact between the Wampanoag tribe and the arrival of Europeans, which begins, at the very late end of the 1500s, 16th century, but very much the 17th century. This is this chapter period of conquest. Yeah, right.
Also known as the first American gentrification project.
And this tribe, the Wampanoag tribe, yeah, are the very same pilgrims, people that the pilgrims met
at
Cape Cod.
Yeah.
In what's now called Cape Cod, right, in Plymouth, which was once called Pawtuxet, which was the sort of capital of the Wampanoag world on the mainland.
Was that?
Because they lived on Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, and all of the, there's like an archipelago there.
Oh, I see.
They lived on all those islands as well as Cape Cod. So when the pilgrims show up in 2021, the Wampanoag population had already been decreased on Cape Cod by about 90%, possibly 95%, were dead already when the pilgrims arrived. That's the backdrop of the first Thanksgiving story. And, of course, this comes out in the movie in Chapter 2, because the Wampanoag worlds were very related. They could get back and forth in canoes, paddling at the right time between the vineyard, Nantucket, the mainland, which is Cape Cod, or any of the other archipelago islands.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they were people of the sea, so they were really badass at doing this. They knew exactly how to do it.
Sure.
So, anyway, all that to say, Chapter 2 is how Europeans obviously conquered them, changed the land, and repurposed it for, intensive monoculture of individual plants and individual animals, cows, horses, sheep, pigs, chickens, show up for the very first time. And with it, the diseases that they get, because when they're domesticated, they get sick. And we get their diseases.
Mm-hmm.
We only get these diseases from domestic animals. Smallpox, chickenpox, et cetera, come from domestic animals. Common cold, influenza, et cetera, et cetera. So humans get those diseases and then pass them on to one another. But they build up immunity over time. But, of course, the Indians had, no immunity whatsoever to any of these diseases, and they would die in heaps. In a matter of weeks, weeks, a whole tribe could be dead.
Yeah.
Smallpox particularly is a, really fast killer. A horrible death. Your body breaks out in these pox that bleed, and they become festering, and they're unbelievably painful. It's a horrible disease. And they didn't know what hit them.
Some researchers
think that that the Indians thought that they had broken their pact with animals. That's
sad.
Yeah.
Yes, that's tragic.
It was the animals' revenge against
them. That's tragic, right?
Totally tragic.
Because then they also had this psychological pain wound that they were carrying around.
So, and then there's a third chapter.
Right.
And the third chapter is the modern island, which I've been shooting on video since 1992 when I got my video camera. I've been
We're going to keep bringing up the formats.
Only once.
Okay.
No, that one I don't mind bringing.
Right. Wait, other people might be shooting that.
Yes.
Now they just shoot digitally without video.
Right.
So it goes direct to computer.
So, like overweight tourists eating ice cream cones on mopeds. Driving down two-lane roads at 36 miles an hour while irate, very high-paying rich people are trying to get back to their yacht or their perfect view or their conquest of the island. So this is the world from inside the Wampanoag tribe. How does it look to them? They get the mic. This is not a historical documentary in the traditional sense of the word. Usually his history is more or less told mm-hmm. by the victors. In this case, no victors talk whatsoever. Just members of the tribe get the mic. They
can't
talk.
Wait to see it. And what's the fourth chapter?
And the fourth chapter is a return to the first chapter where they get their land back.
Oh.
Because pretty much every Indian tribe has the prophecy and really from their point of view the certainty that they will outlive this period of tribulation and they will get their land back. And their way of life will come back. There's an interesting fact out there that I read in a book recently, and that is that the fastest growing demographic of people in the United States are people who identify themselves as Hispanic, and what that really means is Indian, because Hispanic doesn't mean that much from Spain anymore. It means from Mexico or Central and South America.
Right, which were Incan and
that's Aztec. And that's Inca.
Yeah.
And that's Mayan.
Right.
And that's Tiwanaku and all of these like amazing peoples that lived here, you know, for 30, 40,000 years before Europeans showed up. Maybe even a whole hell of a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people who maybe were already here that didn't come over on the, you know, crossing the Bering Strait. You know, a lot of Indian people deny that as you know, how they got here. They say they came from the earth or, you know, all kinds of other wonderfully mythical, you know, delicious stories, you know, that really inform life and make it very, very happy, inform life in a very positive and generous way, you know, mm-hmm. with parables that, you know, teach you how to live communally. Anyway, that's the fourth chapter, this return to the first chapter, which is the mythical time, but the mythical time returns.
Understood. So it's a cycle.
Yeah,
it's a cycle.
And it's in four chapters.
And you've shot it?
Yeah, it's 100% shot.
So you're editing it?
Or
doing kind of post...
I have a bit of a problem with it, and that is there's, you know, divisions within the tribe about my making this movie about the stories that some want to be told and maybe some don't want to be told, that some believe in and some don't, you know. And so I have to now change the movie.
I see.
And it will be changed to be about me. You know, this white guy that wakes up to the depth of the shit that they see. Because I've been allowed on the inside of the tribe, I know it better than most, you know, non-Indian people. And it's become my obsession and my passion to make it be seen from inside their world. But, you know, it's possible that people that I have interviewed or would interview might not represent the whole entire tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that could create divisions within the tribe. And then there's the issue also of if anybody within the tribe maybe were to say bad things about the United States government, the government might possibly look, you know, ill upon that tribe and hold benefits back from them. So then my movie does harm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the last thing in the world I want to do is do
that. Do you think it could draw that kind of attention?
Well, there is this, Bureau of
Indian Affairs. Yeah.
And, you know, they do decide on what tribes get federal recognition and what tribes don't. This tribe has federal recognition. And so they get health care and they get, there's a reservation land that they have that mm-hmm. belongs mm-hmm. to them. And there's, there's food stamps and, you know, their basic necessaries are taken care of more or less.
Mm-hmm.
It's still the poorest county in the state of Massachusetts, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the richest county in the state of Massachusetts as well because there are these you know, incredible McMansions that have been built by really rich people, the heads of government and state and, you know, corporations and on and on and on, and these family trusts. And then there's the Kennedy compound, you know, mm-hmm. and the unbelievably, I'm going on record here as saying something that needs to be talked about, folks. And that is, you know, Jackie Kennedy bought 400 acres, you know, in Gay Head in 1972 or one. Mm-hmm. Raised her kids there, you know, obviously was licking the wounds of her husband and her brother being shot to death. You know, 68, Bobby Kennedy was shot.
Yep.
So, you know, she has two kids, and JFK Jr. grows up there, John Kennedy Jr. And she may or may not have known it, I don't know, but the most sacred spot to the Wampanoag tribe is on the property that she bought.
Yeah.
It's a pond that a mythical whale in the mythical era can escape to when the white man comes, because the progenitor, who was a 400-foot-tall giant, had a dream that, you know, the shit was going to hit the fan and the white man was going to come. And, mm-hmm. and so he gathered all the people together and gave them the choice about whether they wanted to remain on in this period of coming.
So you're suggesting there was a kind of a, I don't know if you'd call it a curse, but there's retribution of some level, because he died young. And
yeah, but not only did he die young, he died in the waters, you know, off his house, 7 miles off the waters, you know, adjacent to his house. And their personal effects, you know, of Kennedy and his wife and sister-in-law, washed up on the beach that he grew up on, mm-hmm. in the same direction that a whale would swim under a trench, into a trench dug by a 400-foot-tall giant who had a dream that the white man was going to come, and then dug this trench under the beach to that very pond mm-hmm. on the land that Jackie Kennedy bought in 71 to escape to. Mm-hmm. So the wreckage, parts of the wreckage and the personal effects are washing up on the beach that the whale would have to swim under into the trench dug by the giant to escape into the very pond that was on the Kennedy property. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
There you go.
Yeah. Plus, I was there the day it happened.
You were
on the island the day it happened. Yeah, and I had taken mushrooms. And I was in this, like, kind of psychic state of mind.
96, 97?
No, 99. 99? July 16th, 1999.
Oh, really? It was
99? Yeah, and I was on the island. And I had taken mushrooms, and I was really, really on a very psychedelic mushroom trip. And I was having a beautiful day. The wind was blowing really strong. Should I go into this or shut up about this?
No, it's fine.
The wind was blowing really strong, but it was a day when the wind would blow strong and stop both. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those days where you could hear the wind down valley mm-hmm. before it got to you, but where you were was calm. Mm-hmm. And then 5 seconds later or 10 seconds later, the wind is upon you. You know, that gathering wind that, you know, gallops down a plane and eventually shows up where you are, but it's not windy all the time. It's mm-hmm. like these gusts that are incredibly dramatic.
Hmm.
So I was loving that. I was loving hearing the wind play the trees as if each tree was a musical instrument.
Yeah.
You know, when you're on mushrooms, you get very sensitive to these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, hearing it go through one tree made it a sound different than the next tree, and then the next one. You know, a bigger one would make a different sound.
Yep.
It's got more leaves.
Yep.
Or different leaves. Anyway, so I'm really enjoying that, and yet I'm getting progressively bugged out by the sound of airplanes in the sky, single-engined airplanes, because it's still the dot-com era, and every dot-com millionaire has bought a plane, and they're up there taking flying lessons, basically. And it's bugging me out. The buzz of the airplanes is yeah. drowning out, in a way, the sound of the wind in the trees. So I'm getting progressively more bugged out about it. And then I started to get into this kind of paranoid jag where I started thinking about planes and plane crashes and how horrible it would be to die in a plane crash. And I'm telling you, by the end of the day, I was so worked up about the death by plane crash that I said to myself in the afternoon before his crash, is there going to be a plane crash? I'm just telling you what happened.
I believe you.
I'm not
yeah.
inventing this.
Right.
That's what happened. And then it was, you know, windy the rest of the day. The plane crash happened at about a quarter to nine, you know, 7 miles, 8 miles out at sea. More than likely, the death of JFK Jr. was a political assassination. I mean, everything, all of the evidence points to that. In many ways, which people can, you know, check out for themselves by searching online.
Mm-hmm.
But contact was made with the airport, with the Martha's Vineyard airport, when they were 7 miles away. A spokesman for the Coast Guard came out and said that when they first heard that Kennedy Jr.'s plane was missing,
mm-hmm.
and said that contact had been made with the tower at Martha's Vineyard.
Meaning somebody called? So, or somebody...
No, the contact had been made by the pilot, by JFK Jr.
Oh.
Yeah, and once contact is made, your position is triangulated. They know exactly where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so if a plane were to crash at that point, they'd know the exact point in which, or more or less the exact point, to search.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of JFK Jr., what happened was when the plane was reported missing, the next thing was that guy was lost. The spokesman for the Coast Guard was lost. He was gone. He was no longer the spokesman. And the Pentagon took the investigation, and a Pentagon person showed up and said that the first guy spoke in error, that there was no contact with the tower. And if there was no contact with the tower, that means the plane could be anywhere. And then 19 hours went by before they found out where the plane actually was, which was not, you know, they thought it was off Long Island at first.
Mm.
So now the story changed from contact being made with the tower to that was a mistake. But these guys don't make mistakes about things like that.
Right.
Anyway, all that to say that I petitioned through an intermediary on the island, the person that I'm working with on the film, great, great Wampanoag elder named Donald Wittes, incredible man, and he made this, by the way. It broke, but he's going to fix it. It's made out of quahog shell. It's a wampum bracelet. And he's a great artist and great philosopher, and was
beautiful.
the chairman of the tribe already in his life, and his family was very instrumental
mm-hmm.
in the tribe getting federal recognition. But anyway, a friend of his was the caretaker of the Kennedy property since day one, and was very close with Jackie and was now working for Caroline. And I wanted to get onto the property to film the pond, the most sacred spot
right,
to
yes.
the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the first artist, I believe, in 15 years that they let onto the property. They let me on.
Oh, yeah.
And I filmed the pond.
And that's in the film, too.
Yeah, that's in the film.
Wow. Oh,
so,
I can't wait to see it.
Anyway, all that to say... and in the Hudson Valley, I'm making a film about the contact between the river tribes and the Dutch also, because mm-hmm. I lived west of Woodstock for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I had enough money to, you know, just shoot. I got a Guggenheim grant, you know, and I was still sort of living off of that money, you
mm-hmm.
know, which
mm-hmm.
was just fabulous. You know, it enabled so much of AKA Martha's Vineyard, as well as...
What kind of numbers are you talking about, just so I have an idea?
Guggenheim gave $50,000.
That's great.
So I was frugal with it.
Yeah. And you can live off longer than that if you're
I basically used all the money for these two films.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
And the one in the Hudson Valley, that one hasn't even been developed yet. But the Martha's Vineyard movie, everything is ready to go.
Other than the
voiceover by me.
Oh, okay. And then you've hashed out. You kind of figured out what you had to do to avoid skirmish, any kind of problems with the.
Yeah, I'm going to make the movie about me. I think in a way it's more interesting. I think also, I mean, not more authentic, hardly. It's just more interesting because the target audience of this is not Indian people who know all this stuff.
Right, yeah, yeah.
It's non-Indian people who don't.
So you're their kind of avatar. You're their kind of guide through this situation.
Yeah, exactly.
You're
the movie's on me. If there's any shit, I'll take the shit. I don't want anybody in the tribe to be harmed by me making a movie that in any way could be construed by any governmental organization as being, uncomplimentary to them.
Right.
So and some retribution might follow. So the other thing is I got a lot going on right now. I got to say, kind of later in the career arc, it's funny how it happens, but I also got a book coming out in a couple of months.
Of photography? Or?
Yeah, 25 years of photography, of street photography.
And who's publishing that?
Powerhouse Press in Dumbo.
Oh, and when is it?
The publishing date is July 26th of this year, 2016.
Well, I think what makes the most sense then is just to sit on this until July, maybe.
Yeah, sure.
Because you're not releasing the film before that, so we could...
Or it would be giving people a heads up.
Heads up. Maybe you can pre-order your copy.
You can pre-order it.
And if you're in, maybe you'll do some sort of event nearby.
Well, maybe you could put this out like the week of the book. Coming out July.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, good.
I don't have.
So the book is pictures, street pictures from Boston and New York, and one from San Francisco, from 1977 until virtually the summer of 2001. So the last moment before the planes hit the towers. In New York. The book is mostly New York, but about 20% of the pictures or 25% of the pictures are from Boston, which is where I started photography in 1977. So after 9/11, I was just shooting video because sound was so important. I mean, I was on the street every day just shooting video right after 9/11 and for the years afterwards, being Reverend Billy's videographer and my own, making my own flicks.
Is that Reverend Billy Talon? Is that his name?
Yeah, Bill Talon.
Talon, excuse me. Yeah,
because we were making a movie together.
Oh, okay.
And I videotaped his exploits for 7 years. He's the anti-capitalist,
anti-shopping. Right.
He has the Church of Stop Shopping. The Stop Shopping Gospel Choir.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful time, actually, because there was such camaraderie,
and
members of the tribe and such interesting, wonderful people. I mean, the heart and soul of the Reverend Billy organization was this wonderful choir.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great vibe. It was actually a great vibe.
Well, I remember I was, showing these films in Brooklyn, in Park Slope, actually, at the Ethical Society building, did a series called Brooklyn Reconstructed, which were all these films about gentrification and land use policy in Brooklyn, because it was happening so quickly and so corruptly by developers and politicians that we showed a movie every month. And, I hosted it and, I curated it. We had lots of community organizers and local folks coming out and doing the Q&As and filmmakers and politicians and, everybody came.
I know they were very involved in that.
Yeah. And I tried to get Billy because we showed one of the films he was in quite a bit. I mean, he's in a couple of them, but he's a, local activist type guy. So, I did invite him, but he didn't end up coming. I did one of them was, whether it was this Coney Island one or maybe it was one of may have been my Brooklyn, I can't remember, but I know I had communicated with him a little bit. it's an awkward spot as we were talking about just opening up another local wound here. but I got to duck out soon.
Okay.
I apologize. I have to, but I have to go to get somewhere by 2. And
okay. So is there any one thing you want to say, or should we cut it now?
Well, we can wind it. I guess we should
you can do for it purposes. Again, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. We can do it. And as a matter of fact, I'd be thrilled to come up if you're upstate. You know, on one of my trips, I would gladly come up. I'm always trying to find an excuse. And when it is, so that's a fait accompli. Obviously, you've it sounds like you were about to. You hadn't quite purchased something up there yet.
No, it hasn't. It hasn't been purchased.
But you have to get out of here now.
Yeah, I'll be out of here.
So, what about the interim's time? Are you?
I'm looking for a place.
Okay, just for the interim.
Yeah, for about maybe 2 months. Okay. I can stay, you know, at different friends' couches and my son's place.
Right.
But I think what I'm going to try to do is go up there and try to, you know, rent a room for 2 months, something like that.
Yeah. Well, clearly you're an exceptionally great guest, I have to say. I couldn't have imagined how great you'd be on this type of thing. I think you should have your own podcast, frankly.
I might just do that.
Well, I can help you with that. I think you'd be really great at it.
I'd love to do it. I mean, I'm from a radio family.
Right. You know, oh, my God. It's in your blood. It's in your DNA.
When I was, 2 years old, my earliest memory in life, it was, 1948, I guess.
Yeah.
And my godmother is saying to me, "That's your mother," pointing to the radio, which was, you know,
you're like, "My mother's not a radio. What are you?"
Formidable. You know, you remember how big they were. They were basically pieces of furniture.
They were furniture.
Large, 4 feet high. Five feet high. And I remember at 2 years old, the disconnect, thinking, how did my mommy get inside the radio?
Well, how did she?
It was the Goldbergs. It was like...
Well, the thing is it obviously, if it's such an indelible part of your childhood and your history, it certainly would inform how you talk and how you tell stories. It's amazing.
And I worked with David Isay, too. That's a story for another time. But
we'll definitely.
We did Gods of Times Square on radio before it came out on as a video.
Wow.
We did a 23-minute NPR piece. And it aired on, it aired on Friday, December 23rd at drive time all across the country. And, you know Gods of Times Square. And it really pulled. It was a heavy-duty piece. It was depending on where you stood, it was early email, and NPR got love letters from people and real hate mail. Email.
Well, you know something? If you ever read those, the 10 best dressed people of the year and the 10 worst dressed people of the year, they're often the same people. Just saying. Well, Richard.
All right. Well, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Switching.